Welcome to the Materials Universe podcast, where we will explore the materials world and how it shapes our lives. My name is Bailey Tibbett, and I will be your host this season. Please join me as I interview researchers from the Center for Dynamics and Control of Materials at the University of Texas at Austin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Materials Universe. I'm your host for the day, Audrey Colgrove, and with me, I have Dr. Rosanna Zia, who is the Dave Wallersheim Professor of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering at the University of Missouri, Columbia. Welcome, Dr. Zia.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, we're so excited. You are our first guest who's traveled to visit with us, and we're very excited to have someone from not just the MRSEC community here at UT talking to us.
I'm delighted to visit.
So to start, we just wanted to start with like a brief explanation of your research. I know there's going to a lot of different facets to it, but if you wouldn't mind giving us a quick intro.
Sure. So broadly speaking, in my lab, we do computational simulations of very small particles in fluids. So teeny tiny particles that are kind of hard to see with the naked eye, and they're so small that they wiggle around in the fluid and they imbue the fluid with very special flow properties. And these can be, they're called suspensions or gels or pastes or glasses, and they can be really flowy or they can be really stiff and like a solid. And there are non-living versions of them like ice cream or paint or pharmaceutical liquids, and living versions of them like monoclonal antibodies or the inside of all your cells.
Let's start with the base liquid. So, what first sparked your interest in colloidal physics, the colloids of this?
So, I really hadn't heard too much about colloid physics until I got to grad school at Caltech. And when you're an incoming first year PhD student, one of your first jobs is to find somebody to do research with. And the department hosted these visits from the faculty in a couple of departments who kind of showcased their research. And our job as first-year students was to find somebody to pick to sign up to do research with. And I remember the day that the person who was to become my PhD advisor was giving his presentation. His name's John Brady. And he put up on his presentation a video of particles undergoing Brownian motion in a liquid. And we always got pizza for these lunches, and I was just about to take a bite of pizza, and I stopped midway through and said, I don't know what that is, but I want to do it for the rest of my life. It just looked really cool. He talked about thermodynamic forces and entropy, and I was just immediately hooked and said, this is how I want to study my research.
So your work started with just the kind of the physics of these of colloids. So not even going into the biosciences quite yet.
Right. I didn't have anything regarding biology or cells or any of that in my mind. My first love in research and in school, in fact, was fluid mechanics and mathematics and physics. I just really like the way things work. And what really caught my attention with his presentation of it was a concept of how entropy could take a really important role in how whole systems operate, that it's a sort of invisible driving force.
Wow, yeah. We've talked a bit about on this podcast about how everything seems to come back to thermo and thermodynamics. And so it's really fun to see that again here. And so you've come quite a bit away from that while still kind of maintaining that base level interest in the base physics of what kind of creates us. Would you mind talking about how you got all the way from colloid physics to studying E. coli?
Sure. So when I started graduate school, like I said, I was really interested in these tiny little particles wiggling around through the invisible hand of entropy and thermodynamics. But at the same time, this motion is called Brownian motion, and it's named after a famous researcher from the early 1800s who, along with a lot of other people, was trying to build strong enough microscopes that we could see the smallest particle that there is, the one that imbued us with life itself. People really wanted to understand what makes us different than a rock. And his name was Robert Brown, and he was pretty famous for building these great microscopes. And one day he burst some pollen grains out of a pollen sack and looked through his microscope and saw all these tiny little particles dancing around like crazy with no apparent driving force. There was nothing causing them to move around with this motion. And he said, I think I found it. I have found the fundamental life force. And he must have thought to himself, I'm going to be famous. But he did the responsible thing. And he said, okay, well, if this is the fundamental life force and it's coming from pollen, we know how to kill pollen. We burn it. And so I'm going to kill the pollen and it will quit moving. And he did, but it didn't. It just kept on wiggling around. And what he figured out from that was that all that mattered in this curious motion is that particles be fundamentally, be that these particles be very small. And he didn't sort out the entire picture of it at that time. It took another 75 years when people like Einstein were trying to prove that matter was made up of atoms and molecules. And it turns out that what was causing all that curious motion was the surrounding water molecules. Mm. So I learned about this experiment, yeah. And there was also a book that was very influential on my learning process, which was Middle World, The Restless Heart of Matter and Life by Mark Hall. And he described this amazing trajectory through science where the way that I view it, that sort of the trajectory through understanding life and understanding matter sort of split off on their paths and they're starting to reunite again. And I was really taken with the idea that physics somehow mediates that transition between inanimate matter and life. And I was really interested in that, but I was getting one PhD. It was in mechanical engineering. I was not getting a PhD in biology. And so I followed that through, but always in the back of my mind, I told myself someday I am going to figure out, at least in some small part, how physics instantiates life itself.
Yeah. I've talked about it on the podcast before, how much I personally connect with that. And I think I just had a little bit of my own pizza moment hearing about that, because there are really... It's really easy nowadays to kind of feel like we know a lot and feel like we know everything. But if you look down to the molecular level, there's so many things we don't know. And if we did know those things, what could we do with it? And so specifically, can you talk about your research into the E. coli, the ribosomes of E. coli?
Sure. And one of the questions you ask was, how did you get from non-living suspensions to E. coli? And a lot of people may not be familiar with E. coli as an interesting bug to study, but rather something nasty to be avoided. But E. coli is an example of a bacterium. Mm-hmm. And it's a really representative bacterium. It was said by Minogue that what's true with E. coli is true with the elephant, meaning that a lot of what we can observe and how this simple bacterium behaves and operates is generalizable to lots and lots of other cells and other life processes. And it's prolific, and there's huge amounts of data that's been generated by experimentalists. And so it's a really great what we call model system. And in science, it's really important to identify a model system just to explore new ideas. And so that's sort of how I landed on that, because it's a really great system for exploring how life works.
Thank you. Well, thank you for pointing that out, because I do remember studying E. coli in college biology classes. It was a neutralized version of it, so we couldn't be impacted by it. But you've answered a question that I had forgotten to ask, actually, about why we were studying E. coli so much. That's really fascinating. So your research is looking at the process that the E. coli ribosomes go through, correct?
Right. And so as we started learning about cell biology and decided we wanted to build a whole cell model of what goes on inside bacterium, one of the most fundamental things that cells do, and very sophisticated things, is build proteins. Yeah. And so there is this little factory inside every cell, almost all cells, that is called the ribosome. And the ribosome translates our mRNA, a messenger RNA molecule. It's a long chain that's coded with all different types of information that's in sequence. And as it translates that, it builds a polypeptide chain. And this comes out the backside of the ribosome. And then it folds itself into a protein. And depending on the sequence that it translates, this will determine how it folds itself up and then what its functions are. It could be something that's involved with metabolism. It could be something that's involved with cell division. It could be something that's helped with heat shock and recovering from those sorts of things. And so the first problem we decided to study to really learn how to speak biology, to learn how to build models, was we said, well, we'd like to understand something about how translation works in E. coli. And one of the things that was really curious is that So E. coli has to make all of its own proteins. And every time it doubles, meaning it divides and replicates, it has to synthesize a huge amount of its dry mass by protein synthesis. And we decided to explore, you know, sort of what drives this process. And a couple of the students that were working with me said, well, how important is Brownian motion in this process? That's how particles get around inside the cytoplasm inside a cell is through Brownian motion, especially in bacteria. They just wiggle around going average on average in all kinds of different directions. Mm-hmm. And how is it that when a cell grows faster, it can make proteins faster? And the consensus at the time held that, well, there's a lot more ribosomes in faster growing cells. So we decided to count. And it turns out that even though there are a lot more ribosomes in faster growing E. coli, there's not enough to account for how much faster proteins are getting made. There was a 15-fold increase in protein synthesis, but only a 9-fold increase in the number of ribosomes. So that was our first problem, was to sort out that mystery.
It's an interesting way to look at the problem, because you looked at the output and kind of looked at one of the tools that was making that output and realized there wasn't enough going on. Mm-hmm. How much of your work is making connections like that?
Well, I think one of the things that I was taught in graduate school is there's kind of sort of two really important ways to approach problems. One is mm-hmm. just curiosity. How does that work? Yeah. And the other one is to answer an unanswered question in the literature, something that's been put out there that, say, experimentalists have measured mm-hmm. that they couldn't explain. And this one was sort of a combination of the two. There was this consensus that, oh, this is how things work. Mm-hmm. And we were curious about it because we wanted to understand how Brownian motion influenced this process. And what we were told by others in, say, the cell biology community is, oh, Brownian motion is so fast, you don't even have to worry about it. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And we weren't satisfied with that answer. We wanted to understand if that was, in fact, the truth. And that's why we started sort of digging into the problem.
Yeah. Why is it important for us to know how quickly E. coli translates the mRNA?
Well, there's a lot we want to know about mm-hmm. how quickly we can make proteins. Mm-hmm. And there, for example, people design antibiotics that target protein synthesis in E. coli and in other pathogens mm-hmm. so that, you know, that's how a lot of antibiotics work and a lot of other drugs is by interfering with that process. Mm-hmm. It's also important to know how that process can break down and if it's going too slow due to some sort of disease that's present. Mm-hmm. Another important offshoot of that is synthetic biology. And this, one of the efforts in synthetic biology is trying to build synthetic cells so we can get them to build the types of proteins that we need, especially for things like therapeutics or other types of biotechnology or even foods.
Yeah. Are there any, like, exciting applications that could come from the work that you're doing with E. coli?
Yeah. One of the things that we're doing, we're building whole cell models, not just of, yes. of E. coli, but also of synthetic bacterium. Mm-hmm. And we don't just work with E. coli. We're also building models of synthetic cells. For example, the JCVI SYN3A cell. This is the minimal cell capable of life. It's a synthetic cell designed by scientists at the J. Craig Venter Institute. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting cell because, if you can imagine it, this has the minimal constituents capable of life process. Mm-hmm. So what we learn from that cell could arguably be broadly applicable to understanding all of life. Yeah. And one thing we do work that's both fundamental and then highly applied. And on the fundamental side, understanding where matter becomes life is a very interesting problem. It's something that we're curious about. Now, what we learn there can help us engineer microbes like E. coli to make proteins for us, to make special proteins, to make new therapeutics, things that will help cure diseases. And so this is the sort of applied end that's really useful.
To kind of zoom out, you're essentially both theorizing and attempting to build virtual models of the actual functionality of cells, which is not something that's really that we have right now. When I think of, like, high school biology classes, I've seen videos in quotes of how cells work, but obviously those have just been theorized in artistic renderings. And so what the work you guys are doing would be ideally, like, an accurate representation of how our cells function?
Well, there's a few different approaches to doing that, and people have been modeling cells for for quite some time. Some of the most sophisticated versions are kinetics-based or metabolic system models from people like Marcus Covert's lab at Stanford or the Luthi Scholten group at Illinois, and they are both very famous for building these kinetics-based whole cell models. And They're able to make these models fast and powerful by abstracting away physical resolution almost entirely and coupling all of these kinetic rate constants together. And they just do an amazing job showing how the metabolic pathways and other processes inside cells are all linked together. And this is really important work. Now, as time has gone on, in the last 10, 15 years, there's been a huge increase in recognition that physical context inside cells, compartmentalization, formation of condensates inside cells, these sort of concentrate things that have to happen inside cells into little sort of tiny factories within the cytoplasm. We represent the genome or the DNA as a physically resolved object. And we represent the ribosomes and the proteins and a whole host of other biomolecules within the cell physically. So that means that these particles wander around and bump into each other. So they actually have space. And that way, you could kind of get a sense. I was once asked, what would happen if I shrunk myself down into a tiny little person and put myself inside a cell? What do I experience? And I usually say it is like the worst game of dodgeball ever when you're standing there and you're just being assailed and assaulted and pelted by balls of all size, bowling balls, ping pong balls, footballs, long sticks, like everything is coming at you. It feels like a zillion miles an hour, and it's extremely crowded and extremely buzzy. And then you get a sense of, wow, okay, so for anything to happen inside the cell, it has to happen in the context of this very crowded environment.
Well, and that goes back to the Brownian physics in some ways, because the physics you'd experience in the cell are quite different than what the physics we experience as just a, you know, an average-sized human on Earth.
Yeah, one of the biggest differences is most of our motion is deterministic, meaning when I intend to walk across the room, I go exactly where I aim to go. And the other thing that's really central to our experience is this sense of inertia. So if I dove into a swimming pool, if I dove off, like, say, the starting block, like you see in the Olympics, and I dove into the water, I could just dive in as hard as I could and then just keep my body straight and go a couple of body lengths in the water before I had to start to move again to propel myself. And the reason I would slow down at all is because eventually the viscous drag of the fluid would overcome the inertia that I carried with me by diving in. And you can get a sense of that by thinking, well, what if I replace the water with, like, cold honey? And so I would dive in and maybe I'd only get maybe a half or a full body length before I had to start moving my arms. Now replace it with tar. I'm going to jump in. My legs are going to be sticking out of the water. I'm just or out of the tar. I won't move at all. And that's because viscous forces have become so much, so important that I don't have any inertia. And life in this regime has evolved to overcome this lack of inertia or lack of the importance of inertia. And that's why microorganisms develop these funny little wiggly tails and spiral tails and cilia on their surfaces, because life at low inertia or low Reynolds number, as we call it, is a much different game. When you get even smaller, so small that you can actually see individual water molecules coming at you, this is where the motion now becomes what we call stochastic or random. I get pelted on all sides of me, and so I just go buzzing around the entire, if I'm in water, just go buzzing around basically in random directions. And so I no longer have any specific control over where I go.
Out of curiosity, does gravity have any impact on such a nano level?
For sure. I think it depends on how small the particles get, but certainly, you know, chemists and people who work with colloidal suspensions definitely use gravitational settling and things like that to do experiments or to pull things out of solution and things like that. But the smaller that particles go, the much less does gravity actually influence the dynamics.
Because it's, you know, it's just the opposite of the kind of astronomical scale that I think people are a little more familiar with thinking about. The gravity of Earth on the scale of the galaxy, it doesn't really make a lot of, it doesn't make a big impact. And so I guess the reverse kind of applies. The gravity of Earth on such a tiny little thing in our cells doesn't make as much of an impact either.
Right. If you've got a really teeny tiny little object, you know, the influence of its size really impacts whether or not gravitational settling is going to affect it.
Wow. Fascinating. All right. To kind of pivot a little bit, just because I do want to hit this, what first got you interested in science?
I was asked this recently, and it's kind of a funny story. I think I was about 4 years old, mm-hmm. and my family I grew up initially in a small town that had a big river running through it, and there was a nice bluff where you could go overlook the river and just sort of watch it going by. And like I said, I was really young. I was about 4 years old, and I was watching the river, and all of a sudden, I was seized with this panic. What if the river runs out? And I turned to my mother and I asked her, what's going to happen when the water runs out? And she said, well, the water won't ever run out. It's coming from up north. It's coming from the glaciers. And I said, oh, what if the glaciers run out? And she said, well, all the water runs out to the oceans. And then when it goes out to the oceans, it evaporates into the air. And then it forms clouds. And then these clouds move around the earth and they snow and they'll replenish the glaciers. And so you don't ever have to worry. And so basically, my mother taught me about conservation of mass when I was four. And I breathed a huge sigh of relief. And I realized that it's really important to be curious and wonder how things work. And I realized then that I love science and I love the earth and I wanted to know more.
Yeah. That's an educational philosophy that, you know, we here at the MRSEC kind of try and, you know, we use as the foundation for all of the work we do. There is no such thing as a dumb question. And we always want to kind of foster that curiosity throughout the years, because we don't want to lose it. How do you work with students who maybe have kind of lost that curiosity to some extent?
I think it's cells and physics and entropy. It's so easy to reignite somebody's imagination with science. And I think one of the biggest challenges we have right now is there's so much competition from intellectual junk food.
Yeah.
There's so much, you know, social media and so much, you know, things on just ready, quick, you know, keep scrolling and get the next interesting thing. But it's sort of like being on a straight diet of sugar. Eventually you get sick of it. And it's not that hard to get students, call students back into thinking and looking at, you know, the really beautiful problems that we have in nature and physics.
I was recently kind of deep diving into something very specific in Greek mythology that I had seen in a museum. And it had me thinking about how impactful and fun it can be to just think about a single topic for, you know, an hour straight and keep deep diving. Is that kind of at all similar to what running a lab group is like?
I think so. I think that's one of the most beautiful things about PhD research is you get paid to really think deeply about a focused problem for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And there are different types of students in a lab. I've had students that are like, I have this analogy that it's kind of like, you know, going out on a fishing boat and sort of trawling the entire shoreline nearby and maybe going out, not even a mile, just going up and down the coastline. Mm-hmm. And I have students that come back and they're like, look at these 25 really cool looking fish that I brought back. And then I have the students who are maybe a little bit more like me, who sail way out miles and miles and lose sight of the shore and drop anchor and just stay there and come back months later, you know, hungry and tired, and said, look at this one giant object I pulled up from the depth. Just one, but look at it. It's amazing and nobody's ever seen it before.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to respect, you know, what type of researcher your students are.
What would you say to someone who looks at your work or work, any kind of, you know, work similar to yours and says, I know why something works. I know why E. coli functions the way it does. Or I know that it functions. Why do I need to know why it functions?
I mean, that's what engineering's for. That's what we do. They say that scientists answer questions and engineers solve problems. Mm-hmm. And in academic research or national labs, we do both. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to understand. A lot of people say that a big part of our future is biotechnology. Mm-hmm. And we've learned how to keep ourselves safe from things like, you know, large animals and big predators and weather and so on and so forth. But what are the things that we're battling the most? Teeny, tiny, little microbes.
Yeah.
And these are the future. The majority of our body is made up of these microbes. So they're part of our health and they're part of our disease and they're part of the future in making new materials. And they're part of, you know, sort of going toward the future and having new strategies for health and for food.
Yeah.
So it's really important to know how to engineer them responsibly and how to use them.
Looking forward in your kind of work, what are the most exciting open questions happening in your field? Maybe colloidal, like hydrodynamics or soft matter physics that you think will be really interesting to watch in the next decade even?
I think a really fundamental one and then a very impactful one.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the most fundamental ones is where does matter become life?
Yeah.
Where does matter go from being inanimate to something that is uniquely associated with living,
yeah,
with the living process? And that's a really interesting problem that we're working on. That's work that we are very thankful to be funded by the Sloan Foundation to study that area of work.
Mm-hmm.
The other area is a really gigantic problem for synthetic biology.
Mm-hmm.
And that's this, you alluded to this earlier, our work in ribosome self-assembly or biosynthesis. As I said earlier, ribosomes make all the proteins in our cells. It's the majority of what's in our cells. They do all the heavy lifting and everything that works in our cells. And in the future, there's a hope that we can make synthetic cells to do a lot of new work for us, to do things like cure disease and provide foods and things like that. But that dream just remains a dream if these cells can't autonomously divide and grow and continue, yeah, to replenish themselves. They have to be able to build their own ribosomes.
Yeah.
This has been an impossible task, is a notoriously difficult problem, is encouraging synthetic cells to make their own ribosomes. They can't.
Yeah.
And so the most exciting work going on in my lab is building models to figure out the minimal conditions, mm-hmm, because we want synthetic cells to be simple, the minimal conditions that foster this process and help them to build their own ribosomes.
Thinking about the minimal conditions, when you're working on that, do you start with just modeling them functioning in the perfect condition and then go backwards, or do you start with nothing and then move forwards?
You sort of describe the two different approaches to,
yeah,
synthetic biology, sort of top down or bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
We start somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
It's really practical to work with this this JCVI SYN3A minimal cell.
Mm-hmm.
Because what's great about it, it's minimal. It's the minimal cell capable of life,
gotcha,
meaning it grows, it divides, it functions. And so this is certainly not the simplest cell or protocell that we hope will ever be in synthetic biology, and people hope to build them bottom up. SYN3A is a top-down cell in many ways, but it gives us a platform to study the minimum conditions in a cell that is dividing and is growing.
Yeah.
But the goal is to devise an even simpler system. And if you can imagine somebody who's building, like my collaborator, Kate Adamala at the University of Minnesota, builds protocells, and she has really amazing capabilities in building these things and obviously wants the simplest system possible to keep things simple. And what we can do to be helpful with that is, I mean, you could imagine if she decided to add components A or components B or combination or component C, it would be this Edisonian task,
yeah,
of sorting through millions and millions of combinations of these things. It would take a long time. And the power of simulations, what we can do is systematically test a lot of different conditions and use different AI tools, mm-hmm, to do screening tests to quickly converge on the best conditions of physical representation inside those cells.
Interesting. That's really awesome. And it makes sense because you sometimes to figure out the simplest way to things, you do need to start with something that's almost there, but not quite.
That's right.
Yeah. But in your work, you had talked about the four stalks of E. coli. So it was part of the ribosomes of E. coli. Am I correct in that?
Yeah. We were talking earlier in our discussion about how E. coli speeds up making proteins when it wants to grow faster. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, the higher number of ribosomes, the protein-making factories, can't explain how much quicker it actually does make these proteins.
Yes.
So we did simulations of this. We built a computer model of E. coli cytoplasm mm-hmm. and its ribosomes and translating mRNA. And we just did physically represented all of these biomolecules. And what turned out to be important is the physical search and matching time that it takes as these ternary complexes is what they're called, mm-hmm. as they try to find the ribosome. And one of the things that we discovered is that the real bottleneck is this thing called codon recognition testing. So when one of these molecules reaches the ribosome, it might have the wrong particle, might have the wrong amino acid. So it has to get tested. Either it's a match or it's a mismatch, or it could be an almost match. And so you can imagine that this, it's called the A site. It does this codon recognition test. And then it, let's say it rejects one or it accepts one. And then it sits there and waits to be loaded again. It's just waiting. Just bring me another one. I'll test it. And what we discovered was the time that it spends sitting there empty and waiting is basically the rate limiter on this process. Mm. Now, we suspected, we got an excellent prediction. Our model was the first to predict this speed up in protein synthesis by replicating these physics. But we wanted a better sort of quantitative agreement of our prediction versus the actual in vivo measurement in cells. One of the things we recognize is that the ribosomes in bacteria have these molecules on their surface. They're like long, sticky tethers that stick out into the cytoplasm called L12 complexes or stalks. And it's been observed that these ternary complexes, the ones that drop off the amino acids to the ribosome, they seem to pool or collocate around these stalks. So we hypothesize that maybe one of their functions is to preload the ribosome and have just some random assembly of these ternary complexes ready to test. Might be the right ones, might be the wrong ones, but they're nearby. And so we built our model to test that, and we got a huge improvement in our agreement with the actual live cell testing. But then I posed to the audience when I was talking earlier today, why does it have four of those? Yeah. Why not two? Why not six? I mean, I don't know, in my book, more is always better, right?
Yeah.
And so we tested that, and we built models where this the ribosome in E. coli had 2, 4, 6, or 8 copies of this thing. Mm-hmm. And we were surprised to find that 4 is the optimum. Yeah. That is the best number for it to grow faster when it wants to grow faster. If it had 6 or 8, what happened is that it would get very crowded right around that A site, and it would become difficult for it to test new, continuously new, ternary complexes. It would be difficult for it to reject ones that were poor matches.
So too many cooks in the kitchen, it's true at a cellular
you
level as well.
You could say that too.
I mean, and I was thinking about it kind of like an assembly line, which I know harkens back a little bit to your time working in the Detroit Ford engineering industry. But yeah, there, like if you, you know, in every sense, in a lot of different places, having too many people or things doing things will always almost slow things down to an extent.
Right. And actually, you know, slow is better for some bacteria.
Yeah.
So in our paper that we published in MBio on this topic, we showed a few different bacteria and how those that tend to grow slower actually tend to have a different number of these L12 stalks.
Yeah.
And so for some, there's sort of these two different strategies a cell can have. It can be in sort of a survival strategy where it wants to grow slower, or it can be like, I want to go like gangbusters and grow fast. And so the number of these L12 stalks seems to be tuned by evolution to meet that need.
Very functional. Because I was thinking about some of the, I was thinking about diseases earlier this week for some reason. And there are definitely certain bacteria that are, their whole thing is that they just want to grow as fast as possible. Whereas there's other bacteria that really want to settle in our cells, settle in our body, and sit tight for a bit before they're ready to move.
Yeah, you know? That's right. And they seem to be the ones that can be the most persistent.
Yes. amazing. Moving on just a little bit, are any of these topics or anything that we haven't talked about, are there any of these that you just really love bringing to your students in your work as a professor?
Well, currently I'm teaching a lot of undergraduate fluid mechanics, mm-hmm. and it's a really interesting time to be a university professor.
Yes.
One of the reasons being is there's just been this explosion of AI tools that, you know, and every professor is confronting this question of, you know, I assign homework to my students and they just stuff it into ChatGPT or their mm-hmm. other favorite large language model and ask it to spit out an answer. And what's interesting is that the students will grind and grind and grind on this process and sort through multiple poor answers from these large language models, and then at the end have to have thought through the whole process anyway.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I like to do to bring students back to the classroom and back to the process of their own thinking is to look around them in the world and look at where fluid mechanics are everywhere, anything from the flow around a commercial aircraft all the way down to the fluid flows inside our tiny little cells that are responsible for getting us up every day out of bed.
Are there any ways that the work you teach or the work you do kind of plays into parts of your home life at all? So any of your hobbies?
That's a good question and not sure I know how to answer.
No worries.
Okay. So it's interesting. I think we were chatting earlier and I was quite proud to announce that I have a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
I think I mentioned that I'm unfortunately a card-carrying workaholic.
Yeah.
But in the last few years, I've made a concerted effort mm-hmm. to develop a hobby.
Yeah.
And it turns out that I enjoy baking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a good experience for me in many ways. For example, I've been doing all this baking. I like to bake cakes.
Yeah.
I was talking with my husband about this and sort of angsting about how is this useful to society and I don't know why this matters and I don't even know why I'm doing this. And my mm-hmm. husband said, because you enjoy it. And this was sort of a watershed moment for me that this is something that I enjoy my research mm-hmm. and so I can find other things to do that I really enjoy.
Yeah.
But I was also commenting to him the other day after one particular disastrous adventure in baking that I said, you know, this is a really good parallel to research. We have to become really comfortable with researchers that we're just not going to get the silver bullet and land on the exact X every single time we walk into the lab. You know, we have to be patient mm-hmm. with trying many different things. And sometimes getting the wrong answer produces something really enjoyable.
Yeah.
Like once I accidentally put in almond extract instead of vanilla extract, mm-hmm. and it was completely wrong and it was fabulous. And it changed the recipe and for baking something. I don't even know what it is anymore. Mm-hmm. But I think we have to get really good at learning from failure.
Yeah.
This is really critical to doing good research. Mm-hmm.
But there's also a freedom to the experimentation that I think comes in baking as well. Are there...
I have to say, baking is very unforgiving of experimentation. And one of the things I really like about baking is there are very specific sort of laws of thermodynamics and
yes.
fluid mechanics. And if you follow those, and that's the thing that's very interesting about it, is there is a science behind everything that succeeds and mm-hmm. everything that fails. And I really like that.
When I think about the experimentation, part of it is experimentation with flavors. But then I love comparing different types of cake recipes. So cakes from different cultures or cakes that contain different things like carrot cake versus like a pound cake. And looking at how the ratios and the methods can impact that final flavor. Have you gotten to play around with that at all in your baking or your work?
Well, I'm afraid I'm not as advanced as you are.
No
right
worries.
Now, I tell people I'm the baking equivalent of a cover band.
That's fair.
I take other people's recipes and just do them really well.
Yeah. I love talking to like children about it because you tell them that, you know, you put all the ingredients together and you can make a cookie. But if you put the ingredients in a different order, what are you going to make? Or if you change the ratios, what are you going to make? And it gets them kind of thinking about the minute parts of the steps can really impact the outcome.
It's a really great way to introduce young people to the scientific method.
Yeah.
And I think this is something that is in danger of getting lost in the mm-hmm. current generation of learners, is
yeah.
that there are detailed ways to look at, you know, arranging a whole bunch of parameters that could mm-hmm. affect the outcome and evaluating those systematically. And that's really critical to teach young people.
Yeah. To kind of go back to the philosophical side you were hitting earlier, we do research because it feels impactful on a grander scale, but sometimes I think we also do research because we find it joyful and impactful in our own way. And so I think there's no matter what, there's going to be merit to your baking and also merit to your research. Have you ever felt that in your research that maybe you were the only one who cared about the topic you were looking into?
You know, I think that the first part of my career, I was really focused on getting really good at a set of tools that were very heavily into applied math and very focused on computational science. And these were absolutely essential to me building tools to do things that were more directly and quickly translatable to impact on everyday science. And so I think that I always knew that what I was doing was interesting and fulfilling, but I very early in my career felt this very, I think, healthy pressure to, I've got to push this towards something. It doesn't matter if it doesn't impact people. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't do curiosity-driven science. I think that's really important to just follow that curiosity. But for me, it's really important to know that more than 10 people will be reading my paper in the world. I'd like to think that what we've done has had a positive impact and affected science more broadly in society.
Well, so thank you so much for being on the Materials Universe with us today. It's been really wonderful having you.
Thank you for having me. This has been great.
Awesome. All right, that's a wrap, y'all.
That's all for today's episode of the Materials Universe podcast. Thank you for listening to our interesting conversations with inspiring guests from different fields of science and engineering. We hope you enjoyed learning something new. Please leave us a review and share this podcast with friends. You can follow us on social media at TexasCDCM on Instagram and X. Thank you to the National Science Foundation and the University of Texas at Austin, and an additional thank you to the Late's Audio Studio crew for their help with the production of this podcast.